I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and I could not be more thrilled about today's episode. Our guest is author, historian, and one of my personal heroes, Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who wrote the National Book Award winning Stamped from the Beginning, as well as this year's New York Times bestseller, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Before we dive into the conversation, I wanted to remind you, everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. Use the link there to shop for the books we've discussed and read the articles we mention. Plus, you'll find our social media accounts in the show notes to keep you connected to The Stacks. If you love this show and want more of The Stacks, check out our Patreon page. You can support the work we're doing and earn perks for yourself, like our virtual book club and more. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to join the fun. And remember, if you like what you hear, take a moment to rate and review this show wherever you get your podcasts, especially Apple Podcasts. Okay, now it's time for my spoiler-free interview with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. All right, you guys, I am sitting here today with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, also famously of Stamped from the Beginning. Ibram, welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you for having me on the show.
This is truly one of my great honors. I love your work. I love your books. So I'm going to try not to fangirl too much, but you'll forgive me, I hope.
<laughs> It's okay. <laughs>
We always start in the same place. In about 30 seconds or so, can you tell us about how to be an anti-racist?
Sure. So How to Be an Anti-Racist makes this sort of case that the opposite of being a racist is not racist. It's being an anti-racist. And not racist has historically been a term of denial, while anti-racist has a very clear definition. So if racist ideas connote racial hierarchy, anti-racist ideas connote racial equality. If racist policies lead to racial inequity, anti-racist policies lead to racial equity. And so obviously in the book, I essentially try to tell the story and share how we can be anti-racist.
Right. And you use a lot of examples from your own life in addition to the history of America and racist ideas in America, and kind of combine those two things to illustrate your points, is right? That's how you say it, maybe.
Yes. Yeah.
So I read Stamped from the Beginning. It was major life changing for me. And one of the things that I'm really curious about is, did you know that How to Be an Anti-Racist was coming when you were writing Stamped, which is more of like a traditional nonfiction kind of text, whereas anti-racist is a little bit more like maybe part memoir, part
You know, so did you kind of have an idea that that's where this was going to be?
No.
No clue?
No.
Did it come? Where did it come from then? How did you decide to do it?
So I think in writing Stamp from the beginning, I during the course of my research, I realized I didn't just want to chronicle the history of racist ideas. I also wanted to chronicle the ideas that were challenging these racist ideas. Mm. And I found out very early on that many of the people who I was characterizing as racist were characterizing themselves as not racist,
right.
Characterizing their ideas as not racist. And so clearly I didn't want to use the very term that was used by the racist that I was chronicling. Mm. And so I decided to use the term anti-racist to sort of contrast that with racist ideas. And the more I spoke about Stamp from the beginning in public, the more I would urge people to be anti-racist. And the more I would urge people to be anti-racist, the more people would be like, well, tell me a little bit more about being an anti-racist, because right. I've been taught to be not racist. And so people just continuously would ask me, how can I be an anti-racist? And that's how I got the idea for the book.
Right. And but you do use a lot of the same history. Mm-hmm. I kind of tell people because I'm a book pusher. I push books on people, and Stamped is one that I like to push on people. And a lot of people started it and got nervous or thought it was too big and they were scared. And it's a lot of racism all at once. And so I told a lot of people, well, how to be an anti-racist is like much more approachable because it gives you examples as opposed to like all of the history. I don't, have you felt like people have responded in that way, or like that people who maybe were scared to pick up Stamped have picked up anti-racist?
I think so.
I think so.
And obviously, you know, we don't have that much time these days. And
right.
So clearly reading a 500-page book can be daunting.
Right.
And not everyone necessarily reads history,
right.
Nonfiction, narrative history. And not everyone reads a history of some of the most horrific things that have ever been said about Black people. And so I think obviously reading any book on racism is difficult. Reading a history book, which I think most people assume is going to be dry,
right.
although I tried to make Stamped
It's not
accessible.
Dry. It's so accessible. It's amazing. Ugh.
And then, of course, the size of it. So I've actually seen, you know, that people have read How to Be an Anti-Racist and then have decided to go and read Stamped from the beginning.
I've heard that same thing, too, which makes me really happy. I'm sure it makes you happy, too.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know if you do this because you're a scholar, but I'm going to ask you anyways. And if you don't, you just tell me I don't do that. How do you suggest that people implement the things that they've learned from this book in situations? I know I follow you on Twitter, and I know you talk about, like, you know, you should be calling out your family members for their racist ideas. But how do you feel like is a way that people can do that without, like, because, you know, when someone says you're being racist, then that's like the pejorative term and everyone freaks out and thinks that it's like you're being a bad person. But you posit that, you know, saying that someone's racist or doing something racist is more of a descriptive term. Mm-hmm. So how do you suggest that people actually like have those conversations in a productive way, you know?
So I think that first and foremost, if people, there are many people who have been trying to have those conversations,
right.
particularly over the last 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and relationships have been strained. And so in those cases, I would actually suggest for people to rebuild the relationship and not necessarily have discussions about racism. And the reason being is because in order for people to strive, take the steps to be anti-racist, they're going to have to be very vulnerable. And in order for them to be vulnerable with you, they're going to have to trust you, and you're going to have a strong relationship. And so that's why it's critical to rebuild that relationship. And while rebuilding it, it's critical to also try to figure out why they're addicted to racism.
Mm.
And so it's just like any other addiction. There's something underlying it that it's critical for you to figure out so that you can potentially, when you have those discussions, when you've rebuilt the relationships, you can speak to those underlying sort of ideas and economic struggles or whatever it is that's actually driving their addiction to racist ideas.
That's so good. And then you just kind of slide your book across the table to them.
Sure.
Sit while you're rebuilding. I just got you this present. Here you go. Enjoy it. So I know that you do the Anti-Racist Book Festival, and you have a children's book version coming out with Jason Reynolds. What other things are you thinking, or like in your perfect world, what's the next 5 years look like for the anti-racist work that you do in the Anti-Racism Center?
So, I mean, I think, you know, there's obviously there's work with the center, and we will be having another National Anti-Racist Book Festival on April 25th of next year.
Okay.
And we actually do have a few projects that we're about to unveil. We can't necessarily unveil them now.
Fine. I was trying to break news.
Yes. You know, but we'll be unveiling them soon. And then, you know, personally, so it's been announced, obviously, the project with Jason Reynolds, and which I'm really excited about. And it's also been announced that I'm working on a board book entitled Anti-Racist Baby. And so really taking and breaking down these concepts in language toddlers can understand and parents can understand in terms of how they can talk to little ones about these issues. We're hoping actually to announce a few other projects pretty soon.
Okay.
But I've also working on which a history of racist policies that would be very similar to Stamp from the Beginning, but instead of ideas, it would be about policies.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. Okay, that sounds amazing. What was the hardest part about writing How to Be an Anti-Racist?
I think in general, obviously, I'm a very, very private person, mm-hmm. and I don't really, like even on social media, I don't talk. I talk sometimes about my personal life, but that's not often. And so basically deciding to use personal narrative was ordinarily very difficult. But then on top of that, the stories that I told were usually some of the most shameful moments, you know, of my life. And so that, of course, was very difficult to, you know, basically share with the world. And then, you know, obviously, when I decided that in certain ways I was going to be a subject of the text, you know, obviously, I was very, very critical of some of the things that I've done and said. And so obviously, you know, to critique yourself publicly is not an easy thing to do. But I thought all of that was necessary in order for the book to be able to relate to people.
Whose idea was it to be personal in the book? Was that your idea, or was that something that, I know sometimes authors, their editors kind of massage them in a direction, or was mm-hmm. that something that you knew you wanted to do, even if it was kind of terrifying?
So, I mean, it was something that I knew that would make the book more compelling and more accessible. And but at the same time, it's not something I wanted to do for the reasons
I just
stated.
It's like medicine.
Exactly. And so, but of course, how to sort of write a text that only really one of the genres is personal narrative. So you, of course, have history in a text. Right. You have social commentary and empirical data. And then in many ways, you have a personal narrative that's largely chronological, but then you also have a thematic chronological narrative. In other words, you have each chapter has a theme, and each theme sort of builds on each other throughout the book. And so it was difficult to write both a personal and thematic chronological sort of story that actually made sense. But, you know, we were able to eventually put it together.
It makes sense. It's good. It's a good book. How long did it take you to write the book?
About 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
What sort of stuff were you reading yourself or watching or listening to while you were doing this work? Not necessarily anti-racist texts, but just like kind of what sort of stuff was feeding your brain while you were going through this process?
So typically when I write books, I try to read novels.
Okay.
And so when I was writing this book, I was mostly reading and listening on audio to novels, just because, you know, obviously you know, novels are, the novelist are, well, I consider novelists to be our greatest of writers. Mm-hmm. To me, in order to write well, you have to read, you know, great writing and great writing regularly. So that's what I tend to sort of read as I'm writing books.
Okay.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You've put out at least 2 really awesome anti-racist book lists. One was for Ralph Northam, and mm-hmm. I think the other one was just like summer reading. Like, go read a book. What is on your personal, brings Ibram joy, excites you, inspires you reading list? So not necessarily all anti-racist, but like, what sort of stuff are you like, if you want to read like me, here's a few things?
Well, I mean, I would say specific authors. And so W.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X and Dorothy Roberts. And I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of Jesmyn Ward's novels and Jacqueline Woodson. And obviously James Baldwin and Maya Angelou.
Okay. Those are all great people. How do you write? Where are you? Do you have snacks and beverages? Do you light a candle? Do you have any rituals? Like, what's the scene for you? Or how do you like to write best, I guess?
So I like to have basically nothing on my schedule for that day, okay. Other than writing. And so typically I just pretty much have like tea and maybe some sort of snack like raisins or something like that. And, you know, I get to my desk at, you know, 8 or 9 a.m. and pretty much write the whole day. And so nothing special other than
Those are special things. Yeah, Everyone has different answers. Like some people they write late at night. Mm-hmm. Some people like to have whiskey. Like everybody thinks their answer is like normal. And then I hear all the answers and I'm like, oh my God, everyone's so different. So I've never had raisins before. That's never been on the show. So you're the first raisins. How did you come to writing books? I know that you're an academic. I know that you're a professor. Did you always want to be a writer, or was that something that you discovered through the process of having to write as part of your education?
So when I was in college, I decided that I wanted to pursue journalism. Okay. And I initially was thinking about broadcast journalism, but then I was like, you know what? I think I'm a better writer than I am speaker. Okay. So I started pursuing, print journalism. And so in my mind, I was, you know, wanted to be a journalist. And it wasn't really until I started pursuing my PhD, and that, you know, I realized that in order for me to essentially do my job and keep my job, that I had to write books. So it wasn't, I think becoming an academic is what ultimately led me down the path to writing books.
And now do you feel like a writer, or do you still feel like it's through your academic? Like, do you feel like that's something that you're happy to be and that's part of your identity in a way that you're excited about? Or is it something that's still kind of like a byproduct?
I probably would see it more as a byproduct.
That's so interesting.
And I mean, I don't really separate the writing from the scholarship.
Sure.
And yes, I mean, when I write, I try to be creative in terms of how I write and the sentences, but ultimately the goal with that is always to communicate scholarship and make it accessible and understandable to people.
And you're a young guy. When I read your book and I was like, carry the one, hold on a second. You're pretty young, like for being such a scholar and for like the work that you do and all the success that you've had and all the things that you've been able to do so far. Do you ever like feel like I can slow down, or do you feel like I'm just going to keep putting the pedal to the metal kind of thing? Because I feel like you're prolific. Like, you've written these great books. You've won a National Book Award. You have the center. What is it like?
I guess my career is very sort of mission oriented in mm-hmm. terms of dismantling racism and, being a part of a movement to erect an anti-racist society. I don't imagine notions like, you know, maybe I can slow down. I mean, obviously, I think on some level, after I finish a book, I don't, you know, turn around the very next day and start a new book, but right. probably in the next few weeks I do.
Right.
So maybe I do take a little break, but yeah, I mean, to me, there's just work to be done and I have to do it.
I'm so glad you do it. I'm curious. So Stand from the Beginning came out in 2016, and then you wrote How to Be an Anti-Racist. It came out this year. When you think back on Stamped, are there things that you maybe would change, or you feel like your thinking has grown and changed in ways about that book, or do you still feel like it holds up for you? Because so much has changed in the world, mm-hmm. I feel like, since the book came out.
So I think two major things. I think the first is that in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I sort of rethought the term racial discrimination. And so commonly, particularly within racial justice circles, racial discrimination is understood as racist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more I thought about that term, particularly the way in which it's been weaponized by racists, the more I realized that instead of us focusing on the discrimination, we should be focusing on the outcome of the discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And as I talk about how to be an anti-racist, it's a very different thing when you have a lily white room and you hold some white people at the door to provide more equity in that room than when you have a diverse room and you hold white people at the door. And so to me, the first, when you're sort of discriminating and it's leading to equity, I would argue now that that's anti-racist discrimination. While when you are essentially creating inequity through discrimination, it's racist. Obviously, the term discrimination has been weaponized by racists with terms like reverse discrimination, like claiming affirmative action, which reduces racial inequity, is racist. And I think that's partly because of our commitment to the term racial discrimination as a pejorative. And so in Stand from the Beginning, I use the term racial discrimination a lot. And so maybe in an updated book, I'd probably wouldn't, I'd probably change that term to racist policy or racist discrimination. And secondly, obviously, I don't really talk much of anything about Trump in, in Stand from the Beginning.
In my version, there's a little something, I think, in the foreword or the afterword, because I have the paperback.
So I think in the paperback edition, I speak about him in the in a new sort of preface. But in the sort of hard copy, you know, I guess the main body, I don't talk about, which I'm kind of conflicted about, because on the one hand, I think one of the problems in the rhetoric around Trump's racism is people have reduced racism to Trump. And, you know, obviously we need to be able to understand racism in everyone who's exuding it and reinforcing it, not just one person. You know, on the other hand, obviously he's a very pivotal figure now within the history of American racism. And so, you know, it seems almost like he should be, he should have a singular role. What I'm imagining, though, is obviously with the racist policies book that I'm hoping to finish one day, he obviously would have a very prominent role in that text.
Do you feel like you've seen a large shift in the way that we talk about racism because of Trump? Aside from, like, that he has become the face of racism and, like, in a lot of ways people think that we had vanquished racism with Obama and then this one person came back and or this one person appeared and now we have racism again. But aside from the, those kind of, like, fantasy ideas that aren't, I don't think, realistic at all, have you seen or maybe heard ways people are engaging with racism or anti-racism in different ways that maybe have surprised you or confounded you or anything like that?
I think that we, I think there has been a segment of Americans who were sort of, who had fell asleep during the Obama era and had imagined that, you know, and I'm, what I mean by, I'm specifically talking about moderate and liberal Americans who had imagined that we were headed along this path of racial progress, that things were sort of looking up and getting better. And when Trump obviously was became president, obviously for them it became harder to maintain that, that idea, that conception. And I think instead they had to confront the reality of how deep and pervasive racism still is in the United States, which then caused those people possibly to begin reassessing themselves and their country for its racism in very serious ways, which, of course, has, I think, been helpful to the anti-racist sort of cause.
Right. So there's a person on Bookstagram. His name is Reggie, and he's my pal, and he also loves your books. And I said to him, I was like, if you could ask, you know, Ibram Kendi anything, what would you ask? And so I said, I would ask you this on his behalf. He wants to know, if you weren't doing the work that you're doing in the Anti-Racism Center, what do you think you'd be doing? Like, maybe what did you imagine your life to be before this, this became your life?
So probably a sports reporter.
And oh, me too. Yeah, I have that dream.
I was initially, when I was a journalism student at FAMU, my main major, my focus was sports reporting. And so I did a ton of internships and you know, in sports sections of newspapers. And that's the sort of path that I was headed until I sort of realized that I wanted to report on race and ultimately wanted to become an academic on it.
Well, who's your team? What's your sport? What do you like?
Well, I'm a huge New York Knicks fan.
Oh, great, because you're from New York, of course. I should have known. I do have a question about something that I noticed as a change between the two books. Mm-hmm. So in Stamped, you kind of have three, you have three categories. You have segregationist, you have assimilationist, and then you have anti-racist. And in How to Be an Anti-Racist, it's kind of two categories. You kind of combine the assimilationist and segregationist into just good old-fashioned racist. Mm-hmm. Why?
So I think in Stamped, well, let me say, I think in How to Be, I do talk about assimilationist and segregationist in the dueling consciousness chapter. But you said, I don't really speak about it regularly after that. The reason being is because I thought that it was already difficult for people to understand the sort of two-way contrast between racist and anti-racist, that to sort of add a third kind without a tremendous amount of historical and evidentiary material, as Stamped does, right, it would have been, I think, difficult for people. And so, obviously, I'm hoping that, you know, people who haven't read Stamped would go and really understand the distinctions between types of racist ideas, segregationist and assimilationist. But I also wanted to make the text less about the sort of contrast between racist ideas and more about these sort of intersectional theory and more about notions of race and biology and ethnicity and culture and behavior, which I think provides the grounding for them to understand those distinctions between the kinds of racist ideas.
That makes a lot of sense. For people who love How to Be an Anti-Racist, what, aside, I guess, I mean, you've already put out these book lists, so this question's a little redundant, but what things do you think are in conversation with your book? What books would you recommend to them? What sort of stuff would you say, I mean, aside from Stamped, to continue their work? Because, you know, I mean, one of the things that you talk about in this book that I should definitely mention is that being an anti-racist is an active condition. It's not, you can't just be one, just like you can't be not racist. You can't just inhabit the anti-racist, just like you say, you can't just be call yourself an activist. You actually have to have achieved some activism to be an activist. You have to achieve some, you know, you have to be working consciously on anti-racism. So what are some texts that you would say are good companion pieces to what you've done here?
So, I mean, well, let me say in general first that any text that sort of documents racist policies in power, which then gives people an understanding of why the racial inequities around them exist, which allows them to better understand those policies as the problem as opposed to people, I think complements the sort of text well. And I also think that there's been an interesting sort of so two texts, for instance, for white people, White Fragility, obviously, by Robin DiAngelo, can be a companion text. And I understand many people who've read that text have read or are reading How to Be an Anti-Racist, because obviously it is a difficult process to be an anti-racist if you're white. And there's no way you're going to be able to do that if you're extremely fragile, right? And the other text for white people, I think, that complements it well is a book called Dying of Whiteness by Jonathan Metzl, in which he specifically looks at white opposition to gun control policies and how in the states that have removed those policies, it's led to an epidemic of white male suicide. So in other words, like
they're dying
from their own, because typically they pushed for the ability to get more guns so they can protect against Latinx immigrants, black criminals and Muslim terrorists. And so their own racist ideas and support for these policies have actually led to a spike in white male suicides. And obviously, the opposition to Obamacare or even universal health care, because they didn't want people of color to get their health care, and now they're dying as a result because they don't have access to health care. He also talks about, and also the, you know, opposition, or I should say the support for cuts in school funding in Kansas. And people just thought that those cuts were going to come down on the Black and Latinx schools. Right. And ultimately they came down on the white schools too. And so, you know, I think that's a great text that sort of looks at the harmful effects to white people on anti-Black policies. Hmm. And then in terms of a text, I think is also a good companion text for how to be for Black people is a text called Locking Up Our Own. Mm. And what James, when that text, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. And I think what James does very well is, like I argue in the text, against this notion that Black people don't have power.
Right.
He shows the way in which in the late 70s, early 80s, you had a lot of Black mayors and Black police chiefs and Black city councilmen and women who had the power to institute harsher sentencing laws, and they did so in some cases. And he specifically looks at Washington, D.C., which, of course, was controlled largely by Black people.
Right.
And so I think that's a very good text for people to understand the context of how there are levels of Black power and how some Black people have used their power to essentially harm Black lives, all the while thinking that they were supporting the community.
Right. Okay, I just have like two more questions mm-hmm. for you. What is the most surprising reaction that you've had to your book, or maybe pushback, or something just that you've been like, oh, so interesting that you heard that or you got that from reading the story?
So actually, I thought that the pushback against my contention that Black people can be racist too, mm-hmm. that the pushback was going to be more. Hmm. And so, of course, you know, there are people who have pushed back against it. But I thought it was going to be much more intense.
Right.
And I don't know whether it's because the pushback has been private.
Hmm.
I know there has certainly been private pushback, or that the people who were pushing back against it decided to sit down and actually read the book.
Hmm.
And they realized that the way they were conceptualizing power was in some ways fraud, and the way they were conceptualizing racist. And so, you know, I thought there would be a greater pushback. But at the same time, I've just seen many, many people of color who've reached out to me and were really pleased that I challenged them, mm-hmm. Or I challenged orthodoxy in that way, because mm-hmm. in a way it liberated them to sort of see who truly are the problems. In other words, they were sort of, it gave them the ability to reflect on their own ideas about other people of color, as well as, like, when they go to these sort of community meetings and that so-called radical speaker stands up and starts going in on this is what's wrong with Black people. They're now seeing those people in completely different ways. Right.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I've been pleased to, about that. And I've just been surprised just about the reception. Like, I would have never thought that it would, like, debut number two.
Which is so amazing. I'm going to cry. I think that's so amazing. The book is so good. And I actually had the same thought. I was like, I hope the book does well. And then I saw where it was and I was like, oh, my God. Like, I think that's really special. Like, mm-hmm. that you're able to write a book about something that's so people are so scared and touchy about, and mm-hmm. that people bought it and are reading it.
Yeah.
Like,
and people are proud that they bought it and they're posting about it and talking about it.
That's so badass. I love that. Who's the coolest person who's expressed interest or who's expressed like gratitude or something from reading any of your books?
There's been so many, probably, probably Angela Davis.
Mm.
And so I had the opportunity to be in conversation with her on stage in San Francisco in January. And she, for those of you who haven't read Stamp from the Beginning, you know, she was a major character in the text. And, you know, for years, you know, I hadn't really heard from her. And so I didn't know whether she, what she thought about the text. Mm. Apparently her sister read the text and then introduced it to her. And she, you know, thought that she really, really liked the text and how I sort of portrayed her. Obviously, I mean, she was portrayed as the most anti-racist, yeah. So I'm sure, you know, it was easier for her to,
right.
to
right.
Than,
right.
than others. But of course, you're, you know, so it was just really reassuring that she, you know, thought highly of the book and thinks highly of my work.
Okay, here's my last question for you. It's kind of open. If you could be in charge of what people take away from How to Be an Anti-Racist, what would you want to make sure that people took away from the book?
I think two things. First, that they would, that the term not racist and race neutral and other terms like that would be eliminated from their vocabulary.
Please.
Secondly, that they would recognize that doing nothing is being racist. Hmm. And thirdly, that we can build an anti-racist society.
Yeah, let's do it. Ibram Kendi, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you
this
for having
me.
This
was so great. And everybody, go out and get How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I challenge you, go get Stamped from the Beginning, too. It's not as scary as you think. I was scared. I have to admit, I was terrified when I started it. And then I've, like, read in 5 days. It's so good. It's readable. It's just a lot of information. But you have, that's why you have a brain. That's why you read,
yes.
So you can learn things. So go out and get both of these books. Ibram, thank you so much for being here. And everybody, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you so much for listening to the Short Stacks today. And of course, thank you again to Ibram X. Kendi. I would also like to thank Ashley Garland, Maria Burkell, and Stacey Stein for making this episode happen. Everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspod.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, head over to patreon.com/thestacks and join the fun. Don't forget, get your lady box before it sells out. Head over to theladygang.com for more info. And make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirajis. This episode of The Stacks was produced by Alan Santiago, and the show was created by me, Tracy Thomas. And I will see you in The Stacks.